with caffeine. The caffeine gives you an instant hit when you take it, and you end up saying to yourself, well, it's definitely doing something. And it is. It's sinking its little hormonal claws into your adrenal system and memorizing your credit card number. There are plenty of good ways to take caffeine. They usually don't involve supplements. So avoid most supplements that contain heavy caffeine. It's there to cover up the weaknesses of the core product. Prescription. Since all supplements are different, and you are different, I'm not going to give you specific amounts to take here. The first step is to supplement your lifestyle in the most natural way possible. Get more sunshine, spinach, and fish, and eat all the weird foods you can. We'll talk about more of that in Chapter 8. Then when it comes to dietary supplements, the best practice is to talk to a healthcare practitioner, dietitian, or functional medicine specialist. It's also important not to expect miracles or dramatic overnight changes. Your problems weren't built in a day. The solutions may not come so quickly either. Since I am acutely aware of how my body functions and feels, hey, it's my job. I can usually feel a difference the day I take a supplement, but I've also learned that sometimes it takes weeks before you accrue the whole body benefits. Track how you feel over time. Do that however you like. Use an app, keep a journal, send yourself an email at the end of each day. Just make sure to get a sense of whether and how something you've taken is affecting you. Pro tip. Don't make me think. Sourcing all these things can be intimidating, but I encourage you to dig in to see what's out there. We've done a lot of the work for you, though, with formulas that pack all of the key vitamins and minerals, along with greens and krill oil, plus a host of herbal nutrients. We like a formula for your gut that includes S. boulardii, a 5-strain probiotic, prebiotics, enzymes, and hydrochloric acid to balance stomach acid. It's the ultimate complete care kit for your gut. You can take a pack of that with lunch. They are sleek, easy to travel with, and absolutely comprehensive. I could pretend that I don't think ours is the best solution, but that would be withholding information from you just to avoid seeming biased. It's what I use, and it's the starting point for our pro team and many of the customers we serve. Now do it. What is a supplement really going to do for me? That's the question you were probably asking as you worked your way through the material in this chapter. It's definitely the question I get most often when I meet new people and tell them what I do. If it's the right supplement, the answer is something. The clinical research backs that up. Suppose your mood is a little better from the vitamin D. When your daughter asks you, "Why, Daddy?" for the 10th time, instead of getting snippy, you can answer her back with a tickle and a smile. Suppose you have more mental energy from the B vitamins. Instead of surfing Facebook at work because your brain is too tired, you actually start working on the long-term project that is going to take your career to the next level. Suppose your joints don't ache after the krill oil. Instead of sliding onto the couch when you get home, you go for a nice long run to clear your head. Suppose you can relax better after mineral supplementation. Instead of being stressed all night, you read a book that changes the way you think about some aspect of your world. Suppose you don't have to worry about getting diarrhea when you travel that world. Maybe you book that trip to Peru and come back a different person. Small things have big consequences. Over time, these consequences compound. We are the accumulated momentum of all our choices. Some of those choices are binary. Go to the gym or not. That choice in that moment is going to change your day. Over time, that choice will change your life. We tend to ignore the importance of fractional benefit because we lose sight of the concept of the tipping point, the little benefit that tips the cup to release a flood of benefit. It may be a 2% difference in force or momentum that flips the coin from heads to tails, or yes to no. Supplements stack the odds in your favor. You will survive without them, but will you thrive without them? Will you be your best? Probably not. You're likely leaving some level of performance on the table. What is that costing you? That's for you to find out. Whether that means scheduling time in the sun, eating MAG greens, taking Epsom salt baths, or purchasing some supplements from a reputable source. The key is to treat yourself like a pro. Because you are a pro. You are professional at being you. You get paid for it, right? So be the best fucking you that you can be. Three pointers. There are two primary reasons to supplement: to remediate potential deficiencies and to gain access to unusual or hard-to-find nutrients. You don't need to think of supplements as something that comes in a capsule either. Getting the right amount of sun, sleep, and food is itself a kind of supplementation and the first line of defense. The key things to consider supplementing are greens, probiotics, B vitamins, krill oil, vitamin D, and additional minerals. While dietary supplements are generally safe and more regulated than you might have heard, they are not all created equal. Look for companies that engage in clinical research on their products and use natural forms of ingredients when possible. Chapter 5. Drive time, alive time. If time be of all things the most precious, wasting time must be the greatest prodigality. Benjamin Franklin. Your commute does not need to be the most dreaded and frustrating part of your day. On the contrary, it can contain some of the most enjoyable and productive minutes of your morning and your evening. But only if you stop looking at your commute as a prison sentence and see it instead as an opportunity. It's a choice to turn the dead time where you can't do anything to a live time where you are learning, growing, or practicing mindfulness. It's a simple distinction. Alive versus dead. Choose to be alive. Getting owned. One of my favorite comedies of all time is Office Space. Directed by Mike Judge, the genius behind Beavis and Butthead, Idiocracy, and Silicon Valley, it's about a software engineer named Peter Gibbons, who has basically had it with his boring life, his unfulfilling relationship, and his dead-end job. Early in the movie, he goes to a hypnotherapist with his soon-to-be ex-girlfriend to get better. He tells the therapist that the reason he's there is that every day is the worst day of his life. His nemesis is a clueless middle manager who passive-aggressively hounds him about making sure he uses the proper cover sheet on his TPS reports. Later on, talking to his neighbor about what he'd do with $1 million, he says he'd sit on his ass, relax, and do nothing. Peter's neighbor, like a redneck Confucius, reminds him that you don't need $1 million to relax and do nothing. Take a look at my cousin, he says. He's broke. Don't do shit. Know where Office Space starts? In the car, on the way to work. In the span of 90 seconds, we see Peter go through anger, frustration, panic, desperation, exasperation, and defeat as he tries to navigate gridlock traffic on the way to a job he hates. Mike Judge made this the very first scene in the film because he knew millions of people would immediately identify with Peter's plight and every single emotion he was experiencing. Office Space came out in 1999, and not a lot has changed about our daily commute since. Actually, that's not true. One thing has changed. Our commute has gotten worse. Since 1980, when the U.S. Census began tracking them, commutes have gotten 20% longer. And it's not just one part of the country. It's all over it. The average New Yorker spends nearly 70 minutes commuting to and from work each day. In Washington, D.C., the average lobbyist, cabinet secretary, and government worker spends 32.8 minutes getting to work. On the West Coast, it takes the average Oakland resident 29.9 minutes to get to her desk, and the average worker in the Inland Empire 29.8 minutes. 3% of the population commutes more than 90 minutes each way. And that's just America, the land of long drives, suburbs, and five-lane highways. In Western Europe, where they supposedly have superior public transportation and are more enlightened about the environment, the average commute is actually longer than America's most congested cities. Better grab another eclair for the road. You would think that in the age of the internet, when we can work from wherever we'd like, all of this would have improved. You'd think that with Uber and ride-sharing apps, the roadways would be less congested, but you'd be wrong. We spend a lot of time in our cars. What makes that so problematic, what sends Peter down a rabbit hole of difficult emotions at the beginning of Office Space, is that more often than not, our time in the car, or on public transportation, does not actually feel like our own. It feels like the Bataan Death March with cars. It feels like a prison sentence. It's no coincidence that bad traffic is called gridlock. You're stuck, homie, with a bunch of other vehicles just like yours with nowhere to escape and there's nothing you can do about it. And because this time doesn't feel like it belongs to us, we tend not to take advantage of it. We don't utilize it, we endure it. We waste it. Which is one of the reasons why, whether we realize it consciously or not, our commute ends up being the time when we are most angry during the day. Foaming at the mouth angry. According to a study conducted by roadside assistance giant AAA in 2016, probably trying to figure out what contributed to all the wrecked cars they were towing away, over 8 million drivers exhibited extreme versions of road rage, while close to half of all drivers exhibited some form of rage while driving. This includes the usual program of honking aggressively, flipping people off, yelling through the window, purposely tailgating and slowing down in front of someone who is purposely tailgating you. That's the professional asshole maneuver, FYI. We're basically getting into a vehicular bar fight every day. And this is at the start of the day. We've already talked about how important it is to set the tone from the get-go for how the rest of the day will proceed. Imagine kicking it off with a shouting match through your car window with some numbnut who cut you off. Whether or not you find yourself on the giving or receiving side of road rage, or whether your commute is short or long, it is likely the worst part of your day. What a waste! This is a full hour of your day we're talking about here. 60 shiny waking minutes. The whole thing incinerated in distraction or frustration. Believe me, I know what it means to be stuck between home and work in a kind of dreaded vehicular limbo. And I know it's even worse on the way back. That's when you know your moments from home. That's when every moment of waiting becomes pure torture. When every accident, every stoplight, every slow merge, every brief pause is keeping you from the rest of your life. Nothing about this is good, but it's also something we have the ability to address. We can take back that time. We can choose to do something with it, to own it instead of being owned and beaten down by it. Because owning the day isn't as simple as drinking the right fluids or eating the right foods. It's about having the right mindset. It's about coming to terms with the fact that at every moment in your life, you have a choice. You can choose to hate your commute, to loathe your fellow drivers, and to waste that time zoning out for 30 to 90 minutes. Or you can choose something different and turn that mind-numbing, soul-sucking commute into time when you are improving and expanding. Owning it. The author Robert Greene has a useful, simple way of thinking about all time. It's either alive or dead. We've all experienced dead time. Dead time is basically everything I just got finished describing. It's every second of Peter Gibbons' life until he goes to the hypnotherapist. It's when we're stuck somewhere we don't want to be, and we give ourselves over to it. We're stuck in line, stuck in a job we don't like, stuck in jail, stuck behind someone driving too slow, and we either give up or give in to the emotions that these situations create within us. If you're like me, you can feel yourself start to burn with impatience. If you're like Peter, you twitch, you fidget, you flail. You just want it to be over. Why can't they just move faster? God. Then there's the opposite, a lifetime. This is a feeling of purpose and progress. You're doing exactly what you want to do at that moment. You are firing on all possible cylinders, and you feel like any task before you could be accomplished with ease and energy left to spare. You are on fire, and you know it. What Green says, and what I agree with, is that any time can be made into a live time because a live time is a choice, just as dead time is a choice. It might sound a little abstract, but think about it. You've already made a series of choices since you woke up this morning. You've gotten up, gotten moving, braced yourself, eaten right, taken supplements, and now you're on your way to work. You chose how to use those other minutes. You chose what to think about, what to put in your body, how to feel. You owned that time. Why can't we do this at any time? Why can't we do this with our commute, even if having to get to work or to school isn't a choice? The truth is, we can. And it's the secret to turning your commute into something you relish rather than something you dread, something to look forward to rather than check out from and waste. Bringing this time to life is a two-step process. It requires preparing and opening your mind, then flexing and filling it. Or as I like to call it, mindfulness and mindfulness. Mindfulness. You've almost certainly heard the words mindfulness or mindfulness practice at some point in the last year. And if I had to guess, you didn't get a clear idea of what those words meant from the person using them. Usually some Silicon Valley entrepreneur on some podcast complaining about how difficult it was for him to find time to appreciate all the money he was making until he built a rock garden or bought a beach house so he could finally build his rock garden. And I bet you turned off that podcast thinking that mindfulness is some special enlightened feeling that takes places in some Edenic location for busy, hyper-successful people. Translation, not you. Either that or you turn it off thinking that mindfulness is total bullshit. Here's the truth. While it is the hottest word out there, referenced in every Medium post and talked about at every conference as some kind of miracle cure for all your problems, anxiety, apathy, focus, loneliness, male pattern baldness, world hunger, you name it, mindfulness is pretty uncomplicated at its core. Mindfulness is simply being aware and conscious in the present moment. That's it. Mindfulness is tuning in only to the sensations of life around you. It is real and serious and sustained focus on the here and now. It's not what's going on in the world. It's not the dozens of angry, frustrated drivers boxing you in on the crowded freeway. Nor is it what you have to do in 15 minutes when the train pulls into your station, or the creeping stress from your job. It's especially not that. In that sense, mindfulness is a type of nothingness. It's not your bank account. It's not your hopes. It's not your fears. It's not any kind of coulda, woulda, shoulda. In that same way, mindfulness is a kind of everythingness. It's you. All of you. Right now. This second, because the only thing that exists is this second. If that sounds a little fuzzy, here's a way to make it more concrete. The next time you're supposed to be doing something and you catch yourself focusing on something else, that is a moment when you're not mindful. You probably have more of those moments than you'd like to admit. But that's why mindfulness as a practice can be so powerful. It can help bring you back to the present moment, and in doing so, expand and prepare your mind for what lies ahead of you for the rest of your day. This is the essence of Zen philosophy. In classic Zen training, the masters proposed four very simple practices, including archery, calligraphy, pouring tea, and arranging flowers. The goal was not to create an impressive result, a bullseye, a masterpiece, the perfect matcha latte, a good-looking vase. The goal was the process itself. Could they devote every bit of their focus to the task at hand without letting their mind wander? Could they take the perfect shot, make the perfect stroke, the one where 100% of their mind, body, and spirit was unified in the task at hand? When I was reading Zen and the Art of Archery, this was a concept I had a hard time understanding. To me, the perfect shot was the one that hit the bullseye. Bam, suck it. But for the Zen masters, the results didn't matter, at least not immediately. the only thing that mattered was my total and complete mindfulness on knocking the arrow, pulling the string, aiming, breathing, and releasing. Eventually, this would lead to not just one lucky bullseye, but a lot of purposeful ones. Yet even that wasn't the point. The point was about life. Instead of rushing from one thing to another, always focused on the past and the future, why not just be here now? Nod to Ram Dass. Zen mindfulness was then and is now the answer to the problem of meditation. Meditation, another buzzword with all the associated apps and gadgets, is really just a strategy for mindfulness. But meditation has an even bigger branding problem, conjuring images of monks on a mountain and especially long, boring sits with our eyes closed. Because most of us have tried meditation and failed to reach the promised nirvana. The problem with meditation is that it typically requires a controlled environment. You need spare time, a body that doesn't ache when you sit still, a quiet space, dim light, your favorite incense, but that's not real life. At best, that's an hour out of your day where you step into an alternate universe to practice your spells, like the Marvel hero Doctor Strange. While being a wizard is undeniably dope, when you need mindfulness the most, those conditions aren't going to be there. That's what the Zen masters realized and what Native American trained tracker turned author Tom Brown realized. You need mindfulness you can take with you, on the road, literally. So he developed a practice that I call the wide peripheral gaze. The wide peripheral gaze. Open your eyes as wide as they go without engaging any muscles of the face. Keep your focus relaxed in the center of your vision. With your mind only, become aware of everything happening at the periphery of your vision. Up, down, left, right. Things might be a little fuzzy, that's fine. Then, still without focusing on anything at all, become aware of everything. Each leaf moving in the wind, people walking by, a bird in the distance, wrinkles in fabric. See everything, focus on nothing. Every moment something will be different, always changing, just like life. It is life. Breathe with your belly. Become aware of all things happening at all times. Become the observer of every detail in the environment, ignoring nothing, yet focusing on nothing. That strange feeling you have now, of a clear mind, of freshness and lightness, that is mindfulness meditation. Nothing more and nothing less. A lot of you might be thinking that pretty much everything I have said in this chapter sounds like I should be whispering it to you on a microphone made out of healing crystals. Fair enough. But mindfulness and meditation isn't backed by crystals. It's backed by gold standard science. Study after study reveals that mindfulness practices have tangible real-world results. One study of over 17,000 medical records shows that those engaging in mindfulness practices are 43% less likely to need any form of hospital care than those who do not. Another meta-analysis of 39 studies totaling 1,140 participants showed robust effectiveness of mindfulness-based therapy for a range of conditions, particularly those conditions related to anxiety and depression. But here's the beauty of what I'm asking you to do. You can do it during your commute. The same time that you could be wasting or raging, you can be practicing mindfulness, turning dead time to alive time. Each morning it takes me about 20 minutes to get to the Onnit office from my home in Austin. Yes, that's right, I have a commute too. When I'm getting owned by my commute, I turn on the radio, then check my Instagram or email at every stoplight. By the time I arrive at work, I am as high-strung as a man on a wire. On the mornings I own it, I try to be present. This can take different forms, depending on a variety of circumstances, but most often it boils down to focusing on my breath, practicing a wide peripheral gaze meditation and being hyper-aware of my body and my surroundings. Sometimes I'll just look at the different shades of green in the leaves, or see all the cars, the people inside, the street art, without looking at anyone or anything in particular. I'll let my mind relax, free from all the decisions I am about to make. Call it Zen and the Art of Getting to Work. Best of all, it's free, it's easy, and it requires no commitment other than choice. Mindfulness. Mindfulness brings the dead time to life, but what I call mindfulness is what animates that time and makes it productive. It fills the mind that you've just focused and opened. This is a practical choice as much as a purposeful one, because if your commute resembles that of the average American, 30 minutes is way too long to do breathwork and drive and try to stare out the sides of your head like a gecko. If you can do it, I applaud you. But most of us, myself included, don't have that kind of focus every day, so we need some other options to use this time well instead of wasting it, to go from being owned by our commute to owning it. That's why I want you to use the rest of the time on your commute to learn something. Sure, you could just turn on the radio and drive around singing at the top of your lungs. That's definitely an option, and everyone has days when they just have to crank it up and break it down. But what if you devoted those spare minutes to studying something, to broadening not just your gaze, but your horizons as well? Imagine what you could do with all those added up minutes. Traveling university. The iPhone is a traveling university. It's not cheap, but it's way cheaper than an MBA. There are no tests at the end of the year, and you can pick your classes. That's why the first thing I do after my mindfulness practice is fire up my phone and put on a podcast. There are thousands to choose from, depending on your interests. In the prescription, we'll get into the details. But for now, I'll tell you what I'm not listening to, the news or talk radio. I don't run a hedge fund, and I'm not into politics. So the idea that I, an average person, should be following breaking news in real time is ridiculous. While I think it's important to be an informed citizen, I'm not interested in making myself miserable by plugging into the 24/7 news cycle of endless outrage and conflict. For the same reason, I strongly suggest you resist talk radio of all political persuasions. The point is to learn something, not gorge on nonsense. Far too much media is designed to provoke and distract, the opposite of both mindfulness and mindfulness. And so when people think they are informing themselves, they are in fact falling for a giant con. Psychologists even have a term for it, narcotizing dysfunction. In fact, the more you follow the news, in some cases, the less likely you are to be an active, involved citizen, because you've confused consuming information with acting on it. If you can avoid the news glut and find your way to some informative podcasts, you'd be surprised how much you can learn. Every day I have someone coming up to me and telling me how a podcast changed his life, sometimes multiple times a day. I believe it to be the single most influential force in media today. I built the entire Onnit empire on the back of podcasts, and you can use them to help you build whatever life you want, too. It was Jim Rohn who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." In my case, that has been literally true. One of the added bonuses about podcasts is that often there are incredible interviews with authors of books. I love to read, and I love audiobooks. But I don't dare start a book until I have heard the author on a podcast. I'm not going to give a book my time and money until I have a really good reason. If I like the interview and there is more to learn, I'm a one-click buy away from my Kindle or my Audible account, digital or audio. An average book takes about 8 hours of listen time, and if your mind is sharp, you can speed that up to 6 hours by moving to 1.5x speed. For most of us, that is going to be a new book every 2 weeks. Talk about leveling up. We'll cover more of my strategies around actually reading books in Chapter 14. Even if podcasts or audiobooks don't change your life, I can promise you this. The 20 minutes you spend listening to a high-quality podcast will feel a lot like when you find a $20 bill in a coat you haven't worn in a while. Unexpectedly, you feel just a little bit wealthier, even though technically you'd had that money all along. In the same way, taking that half hour of mindless time and learning something from it will make you feel like you just got away with something. And you did. You managed to wring some value out of time that you would have wasted. It'll feel amazing. And it should. Prescription. Some of you might work from home. You might not have a commute. Great. Even better. The commute serves as a transition between your profession and the rest of your day. Go ahead and make this transition anyway. If you live and work in an apartment building, put on some headphones and go for a walk. If you're at home, head out into the yard or the porch or walk a few streets. Practicing both mindfulness and mindfulness without actually having the distraction of driving is ideal. For the rest of us relegated to trains, planes, and automobiles, here is the plan. Step 1. Woo-saw, motherfucker. As soon as you get in your car, take 6 deep breaths. Expand your lungs as much as possible and focus your breath into your belly. That same place where the dragon hatches and tells you to melt the traffic in front of you like you were Khaleesi on a bad moon day. A study published by the Japanese Society of Hypertension found that when you take 6 deep breaths over the course of 30 seconds, your blood pressure ends up lower. This will help center you and act as a prophylactic frustration vaccine. Then, if at any other time during the drive or life you feel the dragon coming out, cool him down with 6 more breaths. Remember, it's not 2 breaths, not 5 breaths, it's 6. 6. Step 2. Wide peripheral gaze. The bane of driving is distraction, the opposite of mindfulness. First, practice the wide peripheral gaze when you are stopped. But some of us might be inclined to explore it while driving. After all, every driver's safety class tells you to keep your eyes forward but be aware of your periphery. The goal is to notice even more of your surroundings than ever before. That little squirrel that might run out into the road, or the person not looking when they are backing out. If skillfully employed, you should be in the fucking zone, the big now. The place where martial artists fight from and surfers surf from. But if you feel that this puts you at a safety disadvantage, or you are the slightest bit uncomfortable, then only practice the wide gaze while stopped. Step 3. Learn some shit. Now that you've opened your mind, it's time to fill it. Open your favorite podcast app on your phone and fire up a morsel of mental magic. Since you've made it this far, I feel pretty good recommending the Aubrey Marcus podcast. We explore all elements of human optimization, diving a little deeper and getting a little weirder than even this book will do. As for other inspiration and stimulating conversation, I obviously love the Joe Rogan Experience. Tim Ferriss is essential listening, and Lewis Howe's School of Greatness podcast seldom disappoints. If you need a true kick in the ass, check out Jocko Willink. If you're in the mood to think about diet and lifestyle, I listen to Ben Greenfield's and Sean Stevenson's podcasts. And we even created one that ex-fighter and biohacker extraordinaire Kyle Kingsbury hosts. If you are looking for a great story, nothing beats the real-life tales from Daniele Bolelli's History on Fire or Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. For love and relationships, check out Chris Ryan and Dan Savage. If laughter is your thing, it's pretty much everyone's thing, check out The Fighter and the Kid, hosted by Brendan Schaub and Brian Callen, or The Jason Ellis Show. And finally, to dive deeper into practical spirituality, check out Duncan Trussell's Family Hour. Now do it. My mother, who was a professional tennis player, finishing as high as the semifinals of Wimbledon, always said that flying was the most relaxing thing she ever did. In the days before personal computers, phones, and Wi-Fi, there was literally nothing to do on a plane. There weren't really even consumer headphones or devices to use with them in the 1960s. This was the era of libraries, and she was often traveling around foreign countries, packing only her tennis bag, so she didn't have books either. She couldn't train, she couldn't work on anything, she was free to just be present. It was heaven for her. That is what your car ride can be. Finding these pockets of peace is a critical life skill. We have to build them into the ideal day. We can't just expect to find them. Why shouldn't you be able to sit in the driver's seat of your Corolla or the orange seat of the M train and find peace and serenity? Like all things, you have to work for it. You have to make the time. You have to make the moment into the moment you want it to be. But here's the upside. If you can do this right on your routine ride into work, this is all the meditation you will need for the day. It won't matter if you work at some fancy place like Google that offers multi-denominational meditation nooks. Soon your commute will be a trigger for mindfulness instead of a trigger for road rage. It will be productive instead of destructive. If you are going to own the day, you have to own the hour, and you have to own the minute. These minutes are precious things. They are the only currency we spend every day whose value fluctuates wildly. Spend your minutes investing in your future self, filling your emotional coffers, and building value and enjoyment. Or spend minutes depleting your emotional bank account. Remember what Peter Gibbon wished for if he had $1 million? To sit and do nothing? He had that opportunity every time he got in the car. His wealth was right there in front of him. We all have the same amount of the only currency that matters, time. To spend your minutes well, that is the only goal of a life well lived. Three pointers. There is a fundamental choice when it comes to your commute. You can choose a live time where you are growing, learning, and improving, or dead time where at best you are wasting your time. Those who consistently choose a live time will have a significant advantage in life. To expand your mind and gain actionable information during the commute, check out podcasts or audiobooks, which offer an opportunity to learn that is as valuable as any expensive education. To combat the potential negative impact of the commute, as well as to practice greater presence and peace of mind, use conscious breathing techniques along with mindfulness practices like the wide peripheral gaze. Chapter 6. The Power Plants. The problem with tobacco is inhaling it. Don Howard Lawler. Plants are not just a vital source of essential nutrients and minerals. When used properly, they can also provide mental energy and clarity and unlock greater work capacity as well. Grab an optimized coffee or a nootropic whenever you need a little pick-me-up. Indulge in nicotine to take your work to the next level. Each of these plant-based substances offers something to supercharge your efforts that you can look forward to throughout the day. Getting owned. When you hop off the plane in Cusco, Peru, it's immediately clear why the Incas revered the sun. Over 2 miles closer to this celestial orb than at sea level, the sun there is intensely bright and the air is shockingly thin. The effects of altitude can be so intense that airlines place baskets of leaves for you to chew on at the counter outside the boarding door right as you enter the terminal. The leaves are from the coca plant. They have been used for millennia by the indigenous cultures and shown in clinical research to prevent altitude sickness and boost aerobic energy, which can flag if altitude sickness kicks in. When used the natural way, put in your mouth like chewing tobacco so the many alkaloids can enter your bloodstream through your gums, coca leaves have numerous health benefits and very few side effects. This highlights one of the many beautiful things about the human experience. We have a body perfectly designed to enjoy the foods and drugs that come from the earth. We have a tongue that tastes the earthy, rich flavor of coffee and the astringent smack of a good cup of tea, while our blood cells simultaneously deliver the complex molecules therein to our brains, stimulating production of adrenaline for energy, acetylcholine for focus, dopamine for pleasure, and serotonin for happiness. Who among us wouldn't want a little bit more of any of those? According to the authors of Stealing Fire, the answer is nobody. Everybody wants a little bit more, and they always have. The authors Jamie Wheel and Stephen Kotler make the convincing argument that harnessing these endogenous chemicals, whether from activity or ingestion, is a fundamental evolutionary drive. The problem is these feelings can be too good, and the evolutionary drive for more of them can drive us right off a cliff. You could argue that in some instances, it already has. The feeling of hyper-focus, boundless energy, mind-bending pleasure, and euphoric happiness is so good, people want it so bad, that we refine these plants into drugs and pharmaceuticals to make them hit harder and hit faster. This only makes people want them more, which incentivizes us to make them stronger, and before you know it, we've become addicted. That's when the people who have had no experience with these drugs in their natural form, and who are completely unaware of what plants can do, become scared of their effects and try to outlaw them in all forms, concentrated, synthetic, natural, whatever. This isn't the fault of the plants, obviously. The plants are not the enemy. They are allies, tools to be used for enhancing performance and the enjoyment of our lives. Nope, this is our fault. We have turned plants that can help us reach our fullest potential into toxic drugs that reduce it, and then accepted a daily existence of suboptimal functioning as a consequence. Our altitude-fighting friend, the coca leaf, is a notorious example of this phenomenon, because one of the alkaloids it contains is cocaine. Cocaine comprises about half of 1% of the total coca. It's not a statistically insignificant amount, and it's not so much that they should change the name of the plant to the cocaine bush. But what happens when you chemically isolate, purify, condense, and concentrate it? You get a different animal entirely. You get the powder that is highly stimulating, deleterious to health, and regularly, well, you watch Narcos, right? It is estimated that close to 900,000 people are addicted to cocaine in the United States alone. As recently as 2015, there were an estimated 1.5 million cocaine users over the age of 12. The year before, there were more than 5,000 cocaine overdose deaths, the most since 2007. I've watched cocaine take beautiful bodies and colorful dreams, then dry them and wipe them out, just like we do to the lush green coca leaf. I have friends with similar stories who can trace their origins back to the poppy. Poppy tea was a mild pain-relieving folk medicine. Then it became opium. Then it became heroin. Then it became Oxycontin, Vicodin, and Percocet. Over 36 million people abuse these prescription opiates. 2 million of them are addicts in the United States, with more than 20,000 overdose deaths in their ranks every year. And that's just from the pharmaceutical version. The street drug, heroin, claims another 11,000. The history of tobacco is no less tragic. It went from dried leaves that you burned or chewed, holding the plant in your mouth, to carcinogenic little tubes called cigarettes that are packed with tars and chemicals you breathe deep into your lungs. Cigarettes steal an average of 13 years from a smoker's life and have contributed to a cool 20 million deaths since 1964. What's worse, they also kill innocent bystanders. The CDC estimates that 41,000 people die every year from secondhand smoke. Even caffeine has gone from something you found in tea leaves and coffee beans to a refined synthetic drug we put in cans of soda and Red Bull, or worse, Redline. In all these cases, what began as powerful plants used in their natural form to combat everything from pain to fatigue became some of the most destructive, addictive substances in the world because we humans, in our drive for more, stronger, faster, fucked them all up. Then in many cases, we banned them altogether, effectively removing them from the pantheon of performance allies. That seems to be how it goes with consuming plants in modern society. It's a slippery slope between appreciating them to full-on getting owned by them. If you've ever met a full-blown addict, it's easy to see who is in charge there, and it's typically not the human being. Needless to say, restoring a proper relationship with plants is crucial, not only for our survival, but for this single day in front of us. Owning it. To this point in the audiobook, many of the strategies we've covered have been designed to fill holes and get you back to even. They are the table stakes changes that we all need to make to repair deficiencies that have accrued over time and prevented us from being our most effective self. But here's the thing about that. Mastering these 24 hours is about more than simply being effective. It's about giving yourself the chance to be a boss. A Peruvian-trained vegetalista, or plant doctor, once told me that the plants were entities so evolved and benevolent to humanity that for them to manifest in human form, with all of our capricious emotions and failings, would be a step backward. I don't expect you to take that literally, but it is a beautiful metaphor. Plants are the steady, constant ally of all animal life. Not a single animal would be alive if not for plants. Plants hold no grudge if we do them wrong. They give us the air to breathe, the food we eat, and, on occasion, much-needed medicine for mind, body, and spirit. We have co-evolved with plants, our bodies adapting to receive their benefits over time, as a tree bends toward the light. Plants can be an incredible ally in this way, and if you are going to truly own your day, truly give yourself a chance to do amazing things, then your work starts here, with the help of three powerful plants that can supercharge your efforts, take you to the next level, and help you not only achieve your full potential, but exceed it. Note, I am replacing the prescription section in this chapter with sections called Final Thoughts that offer some guidance and suggestions for each of the power plants we discuss. A relationship with any plant or drug is a very personal choice. The goal here is to have an honest conversation and exploration, and leave you with some actionable information should you decide to pursue it. Caffeine, coffee, tea, and yerba mate. All right, coffee lovers, I've held you back long enough. Now is your time. Finally, you can drink from the cup of Joe, make your daily offering to the Star of Bucks, and crush some well-timed, well-fortified caffeine. Caffeine is one of the most ubiquitous plant substances ingested in the world. There is evidence of tea drinking as far back as 2737 BC, and right now in North America, 90% of adults will have some kind of caffeinated beverage before the day is through. There is a pretty good reason for this. As we discussed in Chapter 1, caffeine releases all three stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol, and norepinephrine, plus mood-boosting serotonin and pleasurable dopamine. No wonder a good cup of coffee feels somewhere between a warm hug and a hard drug. With caffeine's natural ability to block a compound called adenosine, one of the main factors that make the brain register fatigue, a cup of coffee is basically a piping hot crucible of alertness that can help you forge an exceptional day. For this reason, caffeine is the universal drug of choice for the all-nighter and the not-enough-sleep-that-day crowd. You can't go into a police station or a firehouse on an overnight shift without seeing a pot of coffee or a Keurig ready and waiting. Not only does it keep people awake, caffeine has been shown to delay the time it takes for muscles to reach exhaustion, increasing physical performance by 12% on average. For a firefighter, that could very well be the difference between Tommy the Cat making it out of that burning apartment building alive and Tommy the Cat burning through all nine of his lives at once. While it is certainly possible to get caffeine from a variety of plant sources, including guarana berry and kola nut, the original source for cola, the real players in the game are tea and coffee. We're going to break down the advantages of each, so you have a better idea which ally to reach for in which situation. Tea. Like the Michael Jackson song, most caffeinated tea comes from the same plant. It don't matter if it's black or white. Or oolong, green, matcha, sencha, pu'er, or any of the fancy delicious teas that I love. They are all the same species. Camellia sinensis. Just prepared different ways, with roughly the same impact on alertness and physical performance. The only real outlier in the universe of teas is yerba mate, a mainstay in Argentina that the gauchos borrowed from the indigenous tribes who harvested the leaf from the rainforest holly. Yerba mate has some distinct advantages. It doesn't get overly bitter as it steeps, so you can really nurse the caffeine out of it, especially if you have a gourd and a metal straw to mash it up with, as in traditional preparations. You get triple hipster points if you carry one of these in your satchel. Mate is great, and I do have a sentimental spot for a good cup of black or Earl Grey, probably because my mum picked up the habit of tea time at Wimbledon, pinky in the air, don't care. But if you are looking for maximum benefits, the king of all the teas is unequivocally matcha, a tea that has an entire Zen ceremony dedicated to it in Japan. With 66 milligrams of caffeine per 8 ounces of prepared tea, matcha has more caffeine than black tea, but less than a cup of coffee, making it the mama bear of afternoon pick-me-ups. To make matcha, before harvest, the leaves are covered in shade to prevent direct sunlight. This spikes the chlorophyll, as the leaves struggle to draw energy from the sun. Along with chlorophyll, which helps matcha fight bad breath, the leaves produce more L-theanine, an amino acid that improves cognitive function on its own. L-theanine naturally balances some of the potential negative effects of caffeine, like anxiety or jitters, and some studies have shown that the combination of caffeine and L-theanine has unique advantages for brain function, including heightened activity in the alpha frequency brainwaves. We'll talk more about this in Chapter 9. That play a big role in things like focus and attention span. The leaves are then ground up into a luscious green powder of the gods that you can stir or whisk into hot water, or make into any variety of delicious beverages, like the Moe Matchajito. The result is a smoother ride with greater focus than any other natural caffeine source. You can see the full recipe and ingredients list for the Moe Matchajito on the PDF enhancement. Coffee. Despite having gotten extra fancy in recent years in cities like Austin, where I live, coffee has developed much more than a cult following. It is a full-blown religion with an army of very devout parishioners. According to the National Coffee Association, for example, Americans drank 400 million cups a day in 2016. Yes, that's more cups of coffee than there are people. When you consider that Mormons and most babies don't start their days with a piping hot cup of Java, that means regular coffee drinkers are typically knocking back more than one cup every day. Grown on trees in a specific band of heat north or south of the equator called the coffee belt, the bean is removed from the coffee cherry, dried, then ultimately roasted and ground to varying degrees of fineness, after which nearly boiling water is poured or pressed through it until the original black gold drips through the bottom for your drinking pleasure. While coffee shares some of the enhanced physical performance characteristics of all caffeinated substances and includes a healthy amount of antioxidants and nutrients, where it really shines is in its influence on mood. Specifically, drinking coffee has been correlated to a decreased risk of depression. People who drink caffeine at amounts easily found in coffee have a 13% lower chance of depression and are 45% less likely to commit suicide. Perhaps this is due to the serotonergic qualities of coffee, or perhaps it is just that happier people drink more coffee. The jury is still out. What we do know is that coffee helps protect the liver, and in one study where participants drank 3 cups a day for 3 weeks, it was even shown to help support gut health, which could be another explanation for why coffee may assist with depression, since so much of our immune system and neurotransmitter growth occurs in the gut. Whether we're talking about tea for increased focus or coffee for elevated mood, to do caffeine the right way, you have to manage your timing and your tolerance. That's why you're drinking it now instead of first thing in the morning. And you have to slow down its absorption into your bloodstream so it doesn't spike you into the ceiling and then drop you through the floor like you're glued to a giant super ball. To do that, you gotta mix it with fat, just like we did with breakfast, into something I call optimized caffeine. Deep dive. How fat slows caffeine. Why fat with caffeine? Fat is one of the slowest foods to digest, metabolize, in the human system. When you mix caffeine with fat, the body can only effectively metabolize the caffeine as fast as it can metabolize fat. To break down fats, the stomach has to wait for a secretion of bile from the gallbladder. There is a natural rate-limiting factor on this mechanism of action, which forces a slower drip of caffeine into the system. As the caffeine-spurred hormone levels rise slowly, they fall slowly, spreading out the arc and diminishing the spiking and crashing sensation that can come from naked caffeine. Let's get fat. Adding good fat to caffeine is not a new concept. In Tibet, where the conditions are cold and harsh, the work is long, and people need fuel throughout the day, they have been putting yak butter in their tea for ages. We used to do it too, back in the day when we put cream in our coffee and tea. But then it became half and half. And after that, it became skim milk and a bunch of sugar, or worse, 2 pumps of artificially flavored high fructose corn syrup. Unfortunately, this progression, which we thought was doing our body a favor, was actually doing the opposite, substituting a harmful anti-nutrient combination of lactose and sugar for an important macronutrient in the fat-rich cream. In recent years, we've begun to smarten up, thanks to guys like nutrition expert Rob Wolf. When the world was busy squirting cow sugar, aka skim milk, into their coffee, Rob went the other direction and started recommending adding fats like butter, cacao butter, or MCT as supplements to your morning coffee. Not only does that taste delicious, but the feeling of time-released caffeine through fat's slower absorption rate has fueled the butter coffee craze. Still, there are far too many of us trying to get by with low-fat almond milk, soy milk, or rice milk in our coffee and tea. None of which are going to do shit but sweeten our drinks, because none of these milks possess the slow digesting fats necessary to slow down the metabolism of caffeine. In a pinch, full fat dairy like whole cream will do. But better than that is to whip out a blender and add a serving of grass-fed butter, coconut oil, or cacao butter to make a frothy, fatty latte, and get those fat macronutrients into your life. Perhaps the best fat source for your caffeine, though, is MCT oil. Pro tip: emulsified MCT oil. MCT stands for medium-chain triglyceride, a form of saturated fatty acid. These triglycerides are found naturally in coconut and palm oil, but coconut oil provides the best source, free of the environmental cost of destroying palm forests. MCTs serve multiple health benefits, including evidence for improved cognitive function, weight management, and up to 5% more energy. Boom. For high-intensity athletes and those following a higher-fat, lower-carbohydrate diet, MCTs can serve as a vital source of energy due to the liver's ability to easily metabolize MCT into fuel. One of the problems with regular MCT oil, as with any of the other fats mentioned, is that typically fat doesn't mix into water. Only fats that are emulsified, like cream, will mix with a simple stir. Otherwise, you have to blend them in. And I know at my house, a clean blender is as exciting as finding your favorite pair of underwear folded neatly at the top of the drawer. MCT oil is arguably the best fat in the world, and using it as an emulsified creamer that can be stirred into any drink, hot or cold, is a game changer. There are some good brands starting to offer it now, so wherever you can get it, emulsified MCT is hands down the best, simplest way to mix fat with caffeine. Final word. I've got 99 problems, and caffeine might be one of them. Like most good drugs, caffeine has its issues, tolerance and addiction to name two, dehydration and sleep disturbances to name two more. We probably all know people with a really high caffeine tolerance. I remember watching billionaire hedge fund trader Paul Tudor Jones drink a glass bottle of Coca-Cola prior to bed when I was lucky enough to visit him at his Maryland hunting lodge as a child. I know my good friend, former fighter, host, comedian, and podcaster Brendan Schaub can drink coffee pretty much all day and hardly feel a buzz. If either of those hard-charging, successful gentlemen stop drinking caffeine, they might have a problem. That's what the research shows, at least. After reviewing 170 years of data, a Johns Hopkins study in 2004 recognized